Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. I am Gerardo Callsign, SN1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'll be reading for you today in digest format CQ Magazine for the month of April 2009. CQ is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Hand Yam System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Hand Yam members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Hand Yams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or the email address handyham@courage.org. Our website is www.handyham.org. Let's begin today with the CQ editorial, Zero Bias, by Rich Mawson, W2VU. Rich is the editor of CQ Magazine. A change in the wind? Things are changing at the Federal Communications Commission starting at the top, and there is reason to be hopeful that at least some of those changes will be beneficial to amateur radio. As our Washington readout editor Fred Mayer, W5YI, reports in detail in this issue, President Obama has named FCC Commissioner Michael Copps acting chairman and is widely expected to nominate Julia Genachowski as the new permanent chairman. They succeed Kevin Martin, who resigned as chairman and as a commissioner on President Bush's final day in office. You may recall that back in December, a Zero Bias editorial, A New President But No New Sheriff, we took the FCC to task for its failure to name a replacement for amateur radio enforcement czar, Riley Hollingsworth, K4ZDH, who retired last July, and for its failure to initiate a single amateur-related enforcement act in that frame time. We were concerned that the FCC was reneging on its promise made a decade ago to never again leave our self-enforcement efforts without backup from the Commission for those cases in which enforcement action with teeth was required. It soon became clear, though, that the problem may not have been a lack of good intent on the part of the Enforcement Bureau, but rather one of bureaucratic bottlenecks at the very top of the Commission organization. In February, W5YI reported on a stinging staff report issued by a congressional committee blasting Chairman Martin's administration of FCC affairs. One of the big problems cited was that absolutely everything had to be routed through the chairman's office, that virtually nothing could be done without his personal approval, and that, as a result, very little was getting done, including the filing of staff vacancies. The scope of Martin's mismanagement was made clear in the days immediately following his departure, in public comments and an exchange of open letters between Acting Chairman Copps and the Commissioner Robert McDowell, currently the FCC's lone Republican member. In his open letters, McDowell called on Copps to quickly initiate a wide variety of organizational reforms. It appears that Copps was already on the same page, particularly if you read between the lines of his remarks to the FCC staff, just after his appointment as acting chairman. Quoting, "I am troubled that our lines of communication, both internal and external, seem to have frayed," close quote, he told the staff, announcing several moves intended to increase openness and accountability. One particularly telling remark confirmed the charge in a congressional staff report that Chairman Martin had effectively cut off the other commissioner's access to the FCC staff. Quoting, "I also want to ensure that my commission colleagues have unfettered access to the bureaus, with a presumption being that requests for information will be honored," said Copps, adding, "I realize this is not a bureau-created problem, but beginning now, requests from commissioners' offices, not just the chairman's office, should be answered directly and as quickly as possible, just as if the chairman's office is asking for it, and without the need for running those requests through the chairman's office first." Close quote. Copps also reminded the FCC staff that its stakeholders include not just the industries we regulate, more importantly, all citizens. The spectrum is theirs, and the rest of us are stewards. Closing quote. A few days later, Commissioner McDowell told the Federal Communications Bar Association that he had sensed an important boost in morale among the FCC staff since COPS took over, and he made it clear that he supported COPS' early moves. Quoting, "I share and applaud Chairman COPS' view that we delegate some authority back to upper and mid-level management. We ought to have the confidence in our deputy bureau chiefs and division chiefs to handle routine matters and generally discuss their subject areas with anyone, including commissioners, without prior approval from the head of the agency." McDowell also alluded to the growing domination of FCC staff by lawyers. "I am hopeful," he added, "that we will make more efficient use of non-attorney professionals, such as engineers and economists. For example, there is no reason why we cannot use engineers to help investigate complaints and petitions that involve technical and engineering questions." Hallelujah! And remember, he said this to a group of communication lawyers. Subtitle, "A New Sheriff." These words were accompanied by actions. One of the Commission's first moves under Acting Chairman COPS was to reverse a rather bizarre chain of events in the proceeding on TV program carriage rules, whether cable systems had to carry certain program. Initially, last October, the Media Bureau combined a half dozen complaints and designated them for hearing before an administrative law judge, a rather routine action. But less than 2 months later, the Media Bureau issued a series of 3 follow-up orders saying that the judge's authority to hear the cases had expired and that the Bureau would resolve them on its own, presumably with the decisions coming straight from the chairman's office. 1 week after Chairman Martin left, the remaining 3 commissioners reversed those orders. "On our own motion," their order read, "we conclude that the factual determinations required to fairly adjudicate these matters are best resolved through hearings before an administrative law judge, rather than solely through pleadings and exhibits, as contemplated by the Media Bureau. Accordingly, we rescind in full the 3 orders and hereby reinstate the presiding administrative law judge's delegated authority." Plus, one of the first signs that the personnel logjam was breaking was the ARRL's announcement on January 26th that it had learned the FCC had named Laura Smith, an attorney and former lobbyist with significant prior FCC staff experience, to fill Riley's old job as special counsel for amateur radio. At press time, there has been no formal announcement from the commission or indication of when Ms. Smith would begin work. But W5YI was able to confirm that the report is accurate. "We applaud the FCC's new direction at the top and hope it will continue once Mr. Janikowski is formally nominated and confirmed. We also applaud Ms. Smith's appointment as the new AM radio sheriff, and we look forward to renewing enforcement activities on the amateur bands." Subsection, Bumper Satellites. A closing note. As you may have read in the news, and can read about in more detail in this month's VHF Plus column, 2 communications satellites collided in early February, destroying both of them. Our very modest Professor Emil Hasselhoff, whose latest thesis appears in this issue, reminds us that he warned of such a possibility 12 years ago in his article titled "Little LEO's Dirty Secret." Little Leo's Dirty Secret, which predicted the potential for catastrophic collisions among low-Earth orbiting satellites. The good professor, once again, was well ahead of his time. 73 W2VU. We thank Rich Mawson for his commentary in Zero Bias. Let's pick up some ham radio news. Well, here's a name we just talked about, Laura Smith, named to succeed Hollingsworth at FCC. Laura Smith, an attorney, ex-FCC official, ex-lobbyist, and magazine columnist, has been appointed as the FCC's next special counsel for amateur radio, according to the ARRL. Smith worked at the FCC from 1990 to 1998, rising to become deputy division chief of the Public Safety and Private Wireless Division of the Wireless Telecommunications Bureau. She left the FCC to work for the Industrial Telecommunications Association, which she was leading by 2001. More recently, she has been working as a communications lawyer with a Maryland law firm. At press time, her appointment still had not been formally announced by the FCC. Our next news piece, Richard Garriott called W5KWQ to highlight Hamvention. Richard Garriott, W5WKQ, the most recent private citizen to fly in space and talk back to Earth via ham radio, will be a speaker and featured guest at the 2009 Dayton Hamvention, which will double this year as the ARRL National Convention. Garriott is the son of former astronaut Owen Garriott, called W5LFL, the first ham to operate from space in 1983. His flight aboard the International Space Station last year coincided nearly exactly with the 25th anniversary of his father's inauguration of ham radio in space. According to the ARRL, the younger Garriott will be a guest of both the ARRL and AMSAT, will be a forum speaker, and will spend time at the ARRL Expo area, talking with hams and signing autographs. We have a couple of silent keys to announce. VK9NS, K3TUP. Two prominent amateurs became silent keys in February. Well-known DXer, DXpeditioner, and author Jim Smith, Victor Kilo 9, November Sierra, passed away at his Norfolk Island, Australia home on February 10 after a short illness. He was 80 years old. Jim had just published his ham radio memoirs titled The Old Timer. He was a member of the CQDX Hall of Fame. Contester and cancer fighter John Canzius, K3TUP, succumbed to the disease himself on February 18. Canzius used his ham radio knowledge to invent a new treatment that has the potential to revolutionize cancer treatment. Work on his procedure will continue. ARRL adopts CQ guidelines on skimmer. S-K-I-M-M-E-R. Newsline reports that the ARRL's Program and Services Committee has approved the use of the CW Skimmer and other multi-channel decoders in its contests, not only in the assisted and multi-operator categories. In parentheses, at press time, the committee reports submitted to the ARRL Board of Directors prior to its January meeting had not yet been made public. Close parentheses. The CW Skimmer program monitors the full bandwidth of the user's receiver and decodes and types out Morse code characters from multiple stations within the passband. Last year, the CQ Worldwide Contest Committee voted to permit the use of Skimmer-like technology in CQ-sponsored contests, but only in multi-op and assisted categories. The ARRL Committee's decision means that the same basic rule now applies to all major contests. Round the World Sailor, S52YS, presumed dead. Maritime officials say that Jure Sterk, S52YS, is presumed dead after his yacht was found abandoned off Western Australia. Sterk, 72, from Slovenia, was attempting to become the oldest man to sail around the world in an unpowered vessel. He had been keeping the world posted on his progress via ham radio contacts. According to the South Africa Independent Online News site, the Australian Maritime Safety Authority reported that his last contact was made in early January from about 1,900 kilometers, that's about 1,140 miles, off the Australian coast. The shipwreck.org website showed its last report from Jure on January 1. In late January, according to IOL, a merchant vessel spotted Jure's yacht, apparently abandoned and badly damaged, and without its lifeboat. The AMSA reported that its medical experts advised that there would be no way the Stark could have survived so long in the open sea since his last radio contact, and that he should be presumed dead. Stern had sailed around the world once before, a 3-year voyage ending in 1994. New faces at IARU. The International Amateur Radio Union has two new leaders and two new members. The ARRL letter reports that Tim Ellum, Victor Echo 6 Sierra Hotel, has been elected to a 5-year term as IARU president beginning in May. Ellum, from Canada, has been the organization's vice president since 2004. Succeeding Ellum as vice president will be Ole Garpstad, LA2RR, from Norway. He has represented IARU Region 1, that's Europe and Africa, on the IARU's Administrative Council since 2001 and has been chairman of the Region 1 Executive Committee since 2002. In addition, the member societies voted to admit the Emirates Amateur Radio Society and the Kazakhstan Federation of Radio Sports and Radio Amateur to IARU membership. The total number of national amateur radio societies represented by the group is now 162. One last piece in our news section. Scott Redd, spelled R-E-D-D, call K0DQ, Kilo Zero, Delta, Quebec, awarded National Security Medal. Retired Vice Admiral Scott Redd, K0DQ, who stepped down last year as director of the National Counterterrorism Center, was presented with the National Security Medal by President George W. Bush just before his term ended. Redd was recognized for, quoting, his more than 40 years of exceptional service to the nation, strengthening its intelligence capabilities and improving national security, close quote. The medal is the highest award given to members of the national intelligence community. Others recognized the same day included John Negroponte, then Deputy Secretary of State and the first Director of National Intelligence, outgoing DNI Michael McConnell, outgoing CIA Director Michael Hayden, and current CIA Deputy Director Stephen Kappas. Redd, an active ham and contester throughout his long career in government service, is a member of the CQ Amateur Radio Hall of Fame. He was interviewed at length in the February 2008 issue of CQ. Well, folks, the lead-off piece today is a CQ interview with Mark Stenning, S-T-E-N-N-I-N-G. Mark's call is AA1AC, Alpha Alpha 1 Alpha Charlie. He's the CEO for the International Tennis Hall of Fame in Newport, Rhode Island. This interview was conducted and written up by Rich Mawson, W2VU, editor of CQ Magazine. There's a world of difference, it would seem, between the world of amateur radio and the world of professional tennis. Not so, says Mark Stenning, AA1AC, who straddles the two worlds as both an active DXer and DXpeditioner, and as Chief Executive Officer of the International Tennis Hall of Fame in Newport, Rhode Island. The worldwide nature of both amateur radio and tennis is helpful to him in dealing with players and officials from other countries. He says international tennis is, quoting, very similar to the ARRL or the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union, and there are direct analogies in the tennis world. There's something called the International Tennis Federation, which represents 205 countries worldwide. And, for example, when I meet representative from Ghana, who's representing the Tennis Federation there, I know where Accra is. I know what goes on there, because I remember speaking with some Dutch amateurs down there who were very kind to me and telling me all about it. They were there to work in a hospital. And places like Equatorial Guiana, as obscure as they might be on the world stage, may be less obscure now. The fact is that my ham radio background gives me access or requires me to have access to learning more about geography, learning about different languages and different customs. Mark says he's active on all bands from 160 to 10 meters, operating mostly CW and a little bit of phone. He has 344 DXCC entities confirmed, and has operated from the Bahamas, Bermuda, and 4U1 ITU in Vienna. Another of Mark's major ham interests is the Islands on the Air, or IOTA, program, perhaps due to spending his entire life living on NAO-31. Aquidneck Island in Narragansett Bay, the island on which Newport is located. He's been a ham since 1967, starting out as the WN1 IJB. And finally ending up as AA1AC. Quoting again, I was lucky enough to grow up in a very benevolent, let's call it an incubator environment, he explains. My father was a ham radio operator, WA1HXK. My best friend, who lived directly across the street, I was WN1IBJ and he was WN1IJC, remains active, one of my best friends today, and his father was WA1HXJ. So it was the conversation, the camaraderie, the fraternity, which at a very young age was always there. Monday nights were reserved for the Newport County Radio Club, and there are friendships and contacts that I've had for the entire 40 years of my operating life that are some of the strongest friendships I've ever had. Mark said he was bitten early and hard by the DX bug, helped along by some very high-profile contacts. I was probably 12 or 13, and I had just gotten my general license, Mark recalls. I remember 15 meters just fading out in the evening and working Tom Christian, VR6TC, and having my father explain to me the whole Mutiny on the Bounty and the Fletcher Christian connection. And another time, contacting JY1, King Hussein of Jordan at the time, and what a thrill that was, and going to the Globe and learning more about the whole thing. When I first started, you were lucky to get a card back from Russia. And all of the geopolitical changes that take place in the world actually first became evident to me through ham radio. You know, when Czechoslovakia split, we all eagerly anticipated it, less for the political changes there and more for the fact that there was going to be one more DXCC entity. It just gave me much more of a global viewpoint to our perspective. At a much younger age than I think most kids would have, by virtue of the fact that I was not only speaking with these people, but corresponding with them by virtue of QSL cards. I don't know what my postman thought, Rich, when I was 14 years old getting letters from Russia and Eastern European countries and all these different places around the world, but it certainly broadened my perspective big time. As noted above, Mark grew up in and around Newport and is a 1978 graduate of Rhode Island College in Providence, where he majored in psychology. He went to work for the International Tennis Hall of Fame in 1980 as assistant to the executive director, a post he held for 16 years. Quoting, quite honestly, I didn't know what I was getting myself into at the beginning, he told Tennis Week's Steve Flink in 2003, describing the job as like taking a drink from a fire hose, because then Executive Director Colonel Bob Day gave him a lot of responsibility very quickly. Less than 60 days from when I started working at the Hall of Fame, he said, we had our induction ceremonies and I was asked to pick up Lou Hode at the airport. I was learning quickly on the job, and it was all so fascinating and mysterious at the same time. Lou Hode, one of the Hall's 1980 inductees, was a two-time Wimbledon champion in 1956 and 57, also winning the Australian and French Opens in 1956. Explaining a little more about the Hall of Fame, Stenning said, it's a non-profit organization, but we also have a number of international activities. I think when you and I first touched base, I was in Madrid. We had activities in conjunction with the Australian Open in Melbourne, and then hopefully the month after that we'll go to Buenos Aires. Still, no luck in convincing people that we should go to Spratly Island for a dinner or Geyser Reef, but it's still in my dreams. Mark says he also hasn't had much luck working ham radio into his many trips to DX locations. You know, I always dreamed that I'm going to, he says. When I operated at the 4U1 ITU, it was just when I happened to be close enough to Geneva that I could head over there most of the time, unfortunately, virtually all of the time. It's just pretty packed with business. I report to a board of 80, and so it can be intense at times, but hopefully in 10 years or 15 years when I'm retired, I'll revisit those trips with my TS-570, or whatever else is in a tow at that point. Mr. Mawson concludes that, finally, I asked Mark if he had any suggestions for CQ readers. His answer, be the DX. I would certainly encourage that for those who travel or have the ability. reflecting on his many visits to Bermuda and his long friendship there with Ed Kelly, VP9GE, quoting, "I can't tell you how much joy that's brought to my life, the ability to get on a plane in Providence and a couple of hours later be operating in his ham shack in Bermuda, which I have done a couple of times a year for many, many years. I started visiting the island back in 1993, he recalled, and then I became acquainted with Ed, and he was in the process of building a station there. One of the real joys of my life has been not only operating at VP9 slant AA1AC, but getting to know Ed, getting to know his family. I descend upon him a couple of times a year, and then pay for it 6 months later when my bureau shipments start coming in. I've still got one sitting on my kitchen table at home. So the DX bug bit me young and hard, and remains to this day." Mark concluded, "Again, I know I started out with this, the whole history of DX, the Colvins, and Gus Browning, and Marty Lane, and Don Miller. It's just, to me, very, very magical. I think there are times when my family wishes I would grow out of it, Rich, but at age 52, I'm afraid it's with me for life." Let's put in a change of pace now. Magic in the Sky by Jeff Reinhardt, call AA6JR. Jeff titles this piece, "Ain't No Fool." It's sometimes a challenge for a writer to create appropriate material for an April publication, to commemorate a single day of mirth-making in a manner that's worthy of month-long reading requires one to dive deep into the pool of lasting thought. If you write long enough for a monthly publication, you eventually come to realize that your particular column is probably not the first thing every reader turns to, or perhaps your mom is an avid reader of everything you read. Very few readers go through the magazine cover to cover in one sitting and in page order from front to back. Then you realize a sitting is what most readers are doing as they work through a publication, an article at a time, often one a day. It's no accident that Reader's Digest has the same number of articles as there are days in a particular month. Sometimes more than one story is read each day, and that may be lucky for a writer. Therefore, here's my attempt at getting you to chuckle in an April Fool's manner, but maybe on the 13th or the 14th of April. I sure hope it's not the 15th. There's nothing funny about the 15th of April, unless you work for the IRS, in which case it's payday. Maybe that's when you will read Matt's notes, as it seems appropriate for a numbers guy to be read on the 15th, eh? So if it's the 16th, then you're reading this, I'm cool with that. If it's the 29th, all I can say is, hey, I think I'm one up on reading the classified ads placed at the end of the magazine, but that's my bad ego saying that. Toss a squirting flower, as that's jump stuff and not at all recommended as a prank to pull on a lady. Petroleum jelly on the doorknob is old school, not to mention messy, and it's too easy to find the slimy-handed perpetrator. Clear plastic sandwich wrap stretched tightly over the toilet only works in a location frequented by men. Short sheeting the bed is becoming a lost skill, although grape jelly in the bottom third of the bed once generated an interesting reaction from a college roommate. However, the suction cup chrome faucet stuck on an office desk was a winner, especially when I poured some water on the floor beneath it. One of my bosses never did figure out how the real license plate on his car got mounted upside down, but the police officer who called it to his attention was at least sympathetic. One other employee suggested there may have been some utility in that figuring if the car ever flipped over. The person reading the plate would not have to strain his or her back to read it. I, of course, was consoling and empathetic, expressing dismay that some misguided vandal could do such a thing. Going back some and delving into the world of electronics, our high school physics teacher was so fond of going out for a smoke while we were conducting our lab experiments. His mistake was doing that one day while we had access to the Van de Graaff static generator. Our experiment verified that a static charge generated on the inside portion of a doorknob could be received by a person attempting to use that same doorknob from the outside. It is highly recommended that you don't do that particular prank, particularly if the recipient is in a position to grade your performance. There's another universal truism that now makes this kind of activity out of bounds. Shocks can be dangerous. Second, no one likes them. However, in a display of solidarity that was admired, not even the brainy girl who went on to become a doctor squealed. One way I knew she was brainy was discovering that she wouldn't go to the movie with me. She did, however, have a very clean hair, as every time I asked her out, she said she needed to wash it that night. Okay, time to wipe that silly smile off your face. The Dayton Hamvention is coming in May, and unlike last year, fuel prices look like they may be at least somewhere in the affordable range. I'm guessing there may still be some opportunities to find a decent hotel room and line up a friend or two to make the pilgrimage to Ham Radio's Mecca. A road trip is very affordable when the costs are split two or three ways, and it can be downright fun. I've made two road trips from the West Coast, and chances are you're much closer to Dayton than I am in Los Angeles. If you haven't been to Dayton, you need to do so at least once. If you have been to the Hamvention, you don't need me to explain that it's nearly impossible to take it all in with a visit of just one day. It's fun, exciting, entertaining, and stimulating. Besides, you now have to try the Hamfest prank mentioned above. What better place than Dayton? From the flea market bargains to the informative forums and seminars, and of course the vendor displays, don't forget the CQ booth, featuring the latest gear, Dayton is one of those few events that is greater than the sum of its parts. Better yet, it symbolizes so many of the reasons we, as hams, take great pleasure in placing some magic in the sky. Piece assigned 73 Jeff, AA6JR. I have a piece now from the Beginner's Corner by Wayne Yoshida, call KH6WZ. It's titled The Guest Operating Experience. One of the great things about earning a ham license is it is a key that can open many doors of opportunity, including the ability to operate station equipment that does not belong to you. This is why you actually have two licenses when you earn a call sign. A station license, and an operator license also. Just like the fiction character James Bond has a license to kill, radio hams have a license to operate two-way radio communications equipment on a varied selection of frequencies and modes. Think about what this means for a second. By borrowing someone else's station, all you need to do is sit down, turn on the power, aim the antenna if necessary, and start making contacts. Everything is right there waiting for you. The first place to seek access to a station is your radio club. Many radio clubs have established stations with their own call signs, such as W6YRA, University of California, Los Angeles, Ham Radio Club, or have ham gear on to loan. Additionally, there may be club members who are willing to share their station with other operators. This is quite common for radio contests, such as the CQ Worldwide DX contest in the multiple single, that's multiple operators and single transmitter, or multi-multi, which is multiple operators and multiple transmitters categories. The first rule when using anything is to respect the property of its owner. Do not abuse the radio or radios, and if you are not sure how to operate anything in the station, ask for help and do not guess. Also, since many ham shacks are in family homes, it is a good idea to respect the privacy of the other occupants of the house. In addition, it would be a good thing to consider giving something back to the club or the individual that makes the loaner program possible. This can take the form of volunteering for events, becoming a volunteer examiner for the club's testing program, performing antenna work for the station owner, and a whole lot of other things. This is exactly like the concept of sweat equity that is sometimes mentioned in the public television show, This Old House. The benefactors pay the program back in the way of labor to the remodeling or building project. For the station hosts, it would be a good idea to let your guests know about any rules and how to operate the station equipment before the operation starts. Typical rules may include no smoking in the shack, which bathrooms to use, and what areas are off limits. Discussing the rules of the house before station operating begins will avoid any regrets and can save friendships. There are also prominent ham stations that allow guest operations, such as W6RO aboard the Queen Mary in Long Beach, California, and W1AW at the American Radio Relay League headquarters in Newington, Connecticut. Operating these famous stations is great fun because thousands of hams worldwide recognize the call signs, and when they go on the air, everyone wants a chance to make contact. This is Ham Radio's version of a chance meeting with a famous movie or rock star and seeking an autograph. This brings up a ham radio phenomenon called a pileup. This is when a ham station from a rare place gets on the air, or, in this case, a famous station gets on the air. Everyone in the world wants to talk to you when you get on the air with a famous call sign. You are the center of attention. This can be a good thing and a bad thing. Good, because this means that you will make a lot of contacts and everyone wants to talk to you. And bad, because the very large numbers of people calling you creates a mess of noise that you have to sort out and talk to one person at a time. Since you are the station being called, it is your responsibility to make sure people behave. This is called managing the pileup. Because a pileup, by definition, is a crowd, it is important to try to finish making your contacts as quickly and efficiently as possible so you can talk to the next station. Although it is a good thing to have a very interesting and meaningful conversation with the ham operator on the other side of your contact, when a pileup begins to form, you must decide what you want to do. Do you want to continue to have a nice, friendly, comfortable chat, focusing on one contact? Or do you want to answer the many stations calling you? There is no right or wrong answer to this, and there is no unwritten rule about the situation either. It is your responsibility to manage a pileup. You can start or continue it or stop it completely. If you decide not to initiate or encourage a pileup, the procedure is simple. You can either turn off your radio, and the station's calling you will wonder if something wrong happened to you or your station. Or you can announce that you are going to go off the air and clear the frequency. You can say something like this: WA6 and IA from W6RO, thank you for your nice QSO. Take care and have a great weekend. This is W6RO, clear. In the ham radio world, it is usually better to be the one being chased rather than the station doing the chasing. However, on the other side, another human being operating another ham station is patiently waiting his or her turn to make contact. As the generator of a pileup, it is your responsibility to understand this and maintain control, because many stations are waiting in line. Finish up each contact as fast as you can. Just as William Schrunk advises in the title, The Elements of Style, you must, quote, omit needless words, close quote, when working a pileup. As a guest operator, you must always remember your manners. After all, you do not own the equipment, and someone else has made a substantial investment in time and money in creating the station you are using. In addition, if you are lucky enough to put one of the many famous call signs on the air, it is your duty to treat any responsible pileup activity with efficiency and politeness. There are many other tips, techniques, and etiquette in the world of ham radio pileups. This story only scratches the surface of pileup operating. I suggest reading one of my all-time favorite ham radio books to learn more about this style of operating. It's called The Complete DXer, by Bob Locher, L-O-C-H-E-R, called W9-K-N-I. The book is available through the CQ bookstore. Now, in this article, Wayne Yoshida, with the title The Guest Operating Experience, actually, Wayne Yoshida was guest operating at W6RO. The Associated Radio Amateurs of Long Beach manages the W6RO club station aboard the ocean liner Queen Mary in a wireless room located on the sport deck, Queensway Bay, Long Beach Harbor, Long Beach, California. The wireless room features a 10-position radio station. Volunteer hosts operate and assist W6RO visitors from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. daily. Be sure to bring your current FCC amateur license or a photocopy so you can operate this world-famous station and generate a pileup. Well, let's go take a look at satellite collisions in the VHF Plus column authored by Joe Lynch, call N6CL. Satellite collision. Writing for Aviation Week, Frank Mooring Jr. called the orbital collision of two commercial satellites at 1655 UTC on February 10, 2009, the worst ever. The non-operational Russian Cosmos 2251 satellite was involved in a broadside collision with the U.S. Iridium 33 relay satellite owned by the Russian Space Forces and Iridium Satellite LLC, respectively. Records indicate that perigee for the Iridium satellite was 779 kilometers, and for the Cosmos satellite it was 778 kilometers. The impact caused the destruction of both satellites. At the time of the collision, the Iridium satellite was operational. However, the Russian satellite had been out of service for a number of years. A NASA spokesman indicated that this was the first time that two intact satellites have collided. A Russian spokesman for the civilian space agency Roscosmos, Alexander Rovovich, refused to confirm or deny that the satellite was out of control at the time of the collision. Monitoring the aftermath of the collision, Nicholas Johnson, a NASA spokesman, stated that the preliminary estimates indicated that the collision resulted in more than 500 fragments in the debris cloud. This estimate approaches the 2007 Chinese anti-satellite weapon test and the debris cloud it created. The U.S. Space Surveillance Network tracks more than 500 pieces of debris. With this collision, its job got a whole lot bigger. Concerning risk of future collisions from this debris, the NASA spokesman stated that the risk to the International Space Station, which orbits about 430 kilometers, that's 270 miles, below the collision zone, is low. Not so for the Chinese. Their scientists stated that the debris poses a threat to Chinese satellites in sun-synchronous orbits. Speculation immediately increased among amateur radio operators concerning possible meteor shower caused propagation caused by the debris entering the Earth's atmosphere. Most agreed, however, that the re-entry was at too slow a speed to affect any propagation. Your editor would appreciate any reports of propagation that can be attributed to the debris cloud. While no official word from AMSAT has been put forth as of the time of the writing in this column, mid-February, nevertheless, unofficial speculation concerning the effect of the collision on existing amateur radio satellites has also increased. Russian spokesperson Alexander Vorobyev stated that the collision scattered debris between 500 and 1,300 kilometers. Your editor believes that concern for any object in orbit within that 800-kilometer zone in the aftermath of the collision is warranted. Insofar as amateur radio satellites are concerned, AO-51's perigee is 801 kilometers and KO-25's perigee is 797 kilometers. Sources for this piece include AviationWeek.com, Associated Press, and spaceweather.com. Moving along now in the column VHF Plus, the big digital switch. Some did, some didn't. With the postponement to June 12, 2009 of the switch to digital television being made optional, some station owners chose to switch on February 17, while others are choosing to wait until June 12. What this means for weak signal operators is that it is best to wait until June 12 before celebrating the vacating of Channel 2 stations. Some of the weak signal community are hoping that when Channel 4 goes away, the United States might get a 70 megahertz allocation for across the Atlantic USOs. According to Marshall Williams, K5QE, the Central States VHF Society's board of directors requested that the ARRL petition the FCC for such an allocation. Marshall stated that in response to the CSVHFS board's request, they received a letter from ARRL President Joel Harrison, W5ZN, in which he strongly discouraged any attempts to secure such an allocation at this time. Unfortunately, Joel, who is a weak signal operator and a member of CSVHFS, finds himself in the awkward position of representing the league's opposition to the society's proposal. Marshall's concern is that, quoting, if we cannot achieve a 70 megahertz allocation somewhat in harmony with the Region 1 allocations, then no QSOs can be made between the two regions, which means that essentially nothing useful will occur. Close quote. Great Britain's 4-meter band extends between 70.000 and 70.500 megahertz, with a CW and single sideband calling frequency being 70.200 megahertz. While Marshall reported that Joel also discouraged the CSVHFS from independently pursuing a petition, it would seem to your editor that some sort of thin-slice experimental allocation might be able to be achieved in a short run. The success of the 60-meter channelized amateur radio allocation should provide an entree for proposing such an arrangement for 4 meters. Let's take a look at the awards column in CQ for April 2009. The author is Ted Malinowski, called K1BV. It's titled County Hunting and EQSL. In mid-January, CQ editor Rich Mosen, W2VU, announced that CQ will accept for all of its awards contact confirmations made on the EQSL.cc electronic confirmation system. The first USA-CA award using these credits was issued on January 23rd to Donald R. Hint, K-A-5-E-Y-H, whose application contained 480 EQSL confirmations and 20 traditional QSLs. At present, EQSL confirmations are principally useful for fixed stations and not mobiles, which has caused a certain amount of disappointment. We have been in contact with the EQSL personnel responsible for program, have outlined the issue involved, and a way to resolution. Of course, this limitation does not affect the other CQ awards, such as WAZ, WPX, and CQDX, which rely on contacts with fixed stations. All of the CQ awards program rules will have to be modified in order to accommodate this change. If you will be using EQSL confirmations in future USA-CA applications, you should log on to EQSL, choose USACA for the awards listing, and download the file that EQSL will make available to you. This file will contain all the contacts that the system thinks are valid for this award. The first files we reviewed showed errors that listed the county name as USA, or United States, or other invalid data. Someone was not reading instructions here. Using a spreadsheet program, Excel or Quattro, you should delete all the lines that contain bad data. Print a copy of this listing indicating which counties will be counted towards your certificate or endorsement. Most applications will include a mixture of confirmations from traditional QSLs and EQSL. You are still required to submit a complete list of counties being submitted, and this list should clearly show which contacts are from EQSL. I suggest a column with an uppercase E or EQSL uppercase header for these. While there are limitations and problems, we're only beginning in this new era of electronic confirmations. Remember that EQSL is totally voluntary and that there will be a period of getting used to this change. When USA-CA began in the early 1960s, home computers did not exist. Today, ham radio and computer technology are merging, and some of us old-timers sometimes wonder where this will lead. Well, if you're wondering about propagation conditions, a slow rise in solar activities observed. Comments by Thomas Hood and W7US. Solar scientists now report that the statistical and effective end of solar cycle 23 occurred in August 2008. With a start month of October 1996, cycle 23 lasted 11 years and 10 months. This is well within the range of the average 11-year cycle periods observed since the start of official sunspot records. Furthermore, since August 2008, the number of new cycle sunspots, that's determined by their magnetic orientation as compared to the orientation of spots occurring during the last cycle, has been greater than the number of old cycle spots. It is also typical that old sunspots cycle spots occasionally occur for at least 18 months after a new cycle begins. Therefore, don't be surprised by the occasional sunspot that occurs close to the solar equator with a magnetic orientation consistent with solar cycle 23. What's good about current observations since August is that there appears to be a slight yet true rise in solar activity. The smoothed 10.7 centimeter flux readings generally are moving higher, although very slowly. In addition, the geomagnetic activity has been lower than during the last solar minimum. We cannot deduce any significant trends from these lower 8P numbers since we only have records of 8P trends for the last few cycles. Nevertheless, this lower overall geomagnetic activity does appear to positively impact the propagation of HF signals, especially in the lower HF spectrum and in the medium wave spectrum. With such little solar activity, a quiet geomagnetic environment allows the ionospheric structures to remain well-defined and stable. This, in turn, results in stable and reliable communications by way of ionospheric propagation of our radio waves. While the HF hobbyist enjoys the unique conditions of this quiet period, is there any excitement in store for VHF hobbyists? April is typically an exciting VHF month because this is one of two times during the year when aurora are most likely to occur. However, during this period, a low in solar activity as well as prolonged geomagnetic quiet, will there be any auroral events this month? What is the aurora? Aurora is a direct result of solar plasma interacting with gases in the upper atmosphere. It is common to see the aurora during active to severe geomagnetic storms. Geomagnetic storms develop when strong gusts of solar wind carrying solar plasma from coronal jets and coronal holes, or from coronal mass ejections, interact with the Earth's magnetosphere in just the right way. The Earth's magnetosphere is filled with electrons and protons that normally are prevented from escaping into space or descending to the ground by lines of magnetic force. The magnetic force is generated by the Earth, as the Earth is like a giant dipole magnet. The impact of solar plasma breaks loose some of those trapped particles, causing them to rain down on the atmosphere. Gases in the atmosphere start to glow under the impact of these particles. Different gases give out various colors. Think of a neon sign and how the plasma inside the glass tube, when excited, glows with a bright color. These precipitating particles mostly follow the magnetic field lines that run from Earth's magnetic poles and are concentrated in circular regions around the magnetic poles called auroral ovals. These bands expand away from the poles during magnetic storms. The stronger the storm, the greater these ovals will become. Sometimes they grow so large that people at middle latitudes, such as California, can see these northern lights. In the early 1970s, scientists recognized the connection between the component of the interplanetary magnetic field, IMF, that lies along Earth's magnetic axis, and Earth's changing seasons. The average size of B sub Z is greatest each year in early spring and autumn. Why, then, do these storms increase in strength and number during spring and autumn? As the sun rotates, one full rotation occurs every 27 days, the plasma spewing out from the sun forms into a sphere shape known as the Parker spiral, named after the scientists who first described it. The solar wind carries with it an interplanetary magnetic field, which ever expands away from the sun in its spiral. Think of one of those rotating lawn sprinklers with jets of water shooting away from the center. You can see a bending or curving of the water lines. As the Earth moves around the Sun, the spiraling solar winds sweep into the Earth's magnetosphere. How the magnetic field lines in the solar wind interact with the magnetic field lines in the magnetosphere is the key to geometric storms and auroras. Folks, I'm going to close out with a little bit of information here from the FCC. It states FCC calls on amateur radio help with digital TV conversion. Last December, the Federal Communications Commission contacted the American Radio Relay League to ask its members to provide technical education in their communities about the mandated digital TV conversion that is now scheduled to take place in June. Although AWRL Media and Public Relations Manager Alan Pitts, W1HGP, stressed that AM should not make house calls, at least one FCC office suggested that local hands work with city-sponsored converter box installation teams. The city would then send two people to the caller's home to assist in the installation of the digital converter box. That two-person team would go into the homes of the residents and connect the DTV converter boxes and assist with any reception issues. The amateur would be providing the technical expertise, while the volunteer from the local community organization would be providing a comfort factor for the resident who needs assistance. Many amateur radio clubs around the country answered the call to help. In Hawaii, AMS indicated that they developed a good working relationship with the FCC. If the opportunity comes up between now and the June conversion date, consider providing an educational form of public service. In Philadelphia, members of the Holmesburg Amateur Radio Club helped staff the call center at KYWTV. There were questions about the coupon program for the digital converter boxes, poor reception in fringe areas, and how to hook up a converter box. Several members indicated it helped having the experience of working with a converter box prior to staffing the call center and knowing what reception off the air was like. Well, folks, that just about brings me up to time for this month's digest format reading of CQ Magazine for April 2009 here on the Courage Andyham system. CQ Magazine is produced by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Andyham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Andyham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Andyhams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or an email address in lowercase, Andyham, that's spelled H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, it's one word, handyham@courage.org. The website, a fine website, www.handyham.org. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH geographic location is Dartmouth, Massachusetts. We're about 50 miles south of Boston, 7388. Have a great spring season. Bye-bye.